Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Dan Quigley, member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and the club's quarterly chair. We also welcome our listeners on the radio and invite everyone to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, United States Senator from California, Dianne Feinstein. Dianne Feinstein began her distinguished career in public service when she was elected to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors in 1969. She became mayor of the city suddenly in 1978 and was subsequently elected to two full terms as mayor, serving until 1987. After going to the Senate in 1992, she was the first elected woman to join the Judiciary Committee, where she still serves. And she is also a member of the Committees on Appropriations, Rules and Administration, and Energy and Natural Resources. Senator Feinstein has provided creative solutions to important public policy challenges in an array of fields, including national security, cancer research, and the struggle against crime and violence. She has particularly succeeded as a leader in land conservation and environmental stewardship, both in the Senate and in the leadership she provides in solving contentious state and regional issues. She negotiated a public-private purchase of 16,500 acres of San Francisco Bay salt ponds so that the largest wetland restoration in California is now underway. She has led the efforts that now protect more than 7,500 acres of old-growth redwoods, as well as more than 7 million acres of pristine California desert. Protecting forests, preserving California's water supply and ecology, safeguarding Lake Tahoe, the list of her environmental accomplishments is, in a word, inspiring. We are honored to have her with us today to share her thoughts and proposals on a global environmental challenge that is at once urgent and long-term, and for which the solutions must be both individual and collective. Please join me in welcoming Senator Dianne Feinstein.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Members and friends of the Commonwealth Club, I'm very pleased to be here tonight. I'm pleased because some of my family is here, my husband, my stepdaughter, friends are here, and you're here. So thank you very much. I am going to discuss global warming, which I believe is the greatest environmental challenge facing this planet. So let me get right to it. The first 7 months of this year were the warmest in the United States since national-scale record-keeping began in 1895. And based on nearly every scientific prediction, it's only going to get warmer. The question is, how warm and why? First, how warm? If further temperature increases are kept to 1 to 2 degrees Fahrenheit, it will be manageable. But if warming increases from 5 to 10 degrees or even more, the effects on our planet will be catastrophic. So we've got to begin now to take certain steps. So each of us is confronted with a choice that will impact not only our future, but the futures of our children and grandchildren. Do we continue with a business-as-usual attitude, or do we make the changes we need to prevent catastrophe? Now for the question, why? Quite simply, because we are addicted to fossil fuels. And it is the burning of these fuels, coal, oil, gasoline, and even natural gas, and the resultant greenhouse gas emissions. Those are the primary causes of global warming. Carbon dioxide, the most plentiful of the man-made greenhouse gases, is produced by power plants, cars, manufacturing, and by residential and commercial building components. And here is the key. Carbon dioxide doesn't dissipate quickly in the atmosphere. It stays in the atmosphere for 5 decades or more, causing the Earth's temperature to rise. That means that much of the carbon dioxide produced in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s is still in the atmosphere today. And the carbon dioxide produced today will still be in the atmosphere 2050 and beyond. Many of the world's most prominent scientists, including those at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, with whom I talked just 3 days ago, and the University of California campuses, and the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, all predict serious and even catastrophic consequences for our planet unless we make major changes in our consumption of energy and strongly move away from energy sources that produce the gases that cause global warming, namely carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, and methane. They say that to stabilize the planet's climate by the end of the century, this is important, we need a 70% reduction in carbon dioxide's emissions below 1990 levels by 2050. So the goal should be to stabilize carbon dioxide at 450 parts per million by 2050. This could restrict further warming to 1 to 2 degrees Fahrenheit. We can't stop it at this point. The Earth has already warmed 1 degree in the past century. And you may say that's not much, but actually the results have been dramatic. The 1990s were the hottest decade since record keeping was begun. And judging from tree rings and other proxy measures, probably the last 2,000 years. Glaciers are melting, coral reefs are dying, species are disappearing. Extreme weather patterns have evolved. Heat waves, droughts, hurricanes, floods, and there are signs that they may be occurring with greater frequency and greater intensity. Global warming is also touching us closer to home. Two examples are the shrinking of the Western United States snowpack and the increasing scope and intensity of forest fires in the West. And the vast majority of climate scientists think that this is just the beginning of the warming syndrome. Things will only get worse as temperatures rise. The question is, how much will the increase be? If temperatures increase the 1 to 2 degrees over the next 50 years, we're going to see major but likely manageable shifts in the world around us. For example, the Sierra Nevada snowpack would shrink by about 30% with 1 to 2 degrees. Sea levels will rise some 6 inches, perhaps more. Large wildfires will increase by 10%. And electricity demand in California would increase by 3%. These are significant changes, but it's possible to adapt to them. But if nothing is done, if the Earth warms 5 degrees Fahrenheit or more in the next 50 years, the pace of change will increase dramatically. Our ability to adapt will be much tougher, and the face of our planet will change enormously and forever. According to scientific estimates, oceans will rise, flooding will occur, hurricanes, tornadoes, and other severe weather will become more volatile than ever. Malaria will spread. Here in California, 1/2 to 2/3 of the Sierra Nevada snowpack will disappear. That's equal to the water supply for the 16 million people in the Los Angeles basin. Sea levels will rise more than 2 feet, leading to catastrophic flooding, and especially vulnerable would be the San Francisco Bay Delta, a conduit for much of California's fresh water and home to sensitive tidelands and levied islands. Risk of catastrophic wildfire would more than double, and energy demands would increase 10 to 20% in our state. We had a mild taste of the future in July. Here in the city, temperatures spiked to 97 degrees, and it was far worse in other areas of our state. More than 160 people died. Death Valley temperatures soared to 126 degrees. Increasingly, scientists warn us that we may be at a tipping point. Beyond a certain amount of climate change, we lose the ability to come back and avoid catastrophe. So refuse to act, or act too slowly, and humans will have caused the most sudden temperature shift since the dawn of civilization. But if we act soon and decisively, further global warming can be limited to the 1 to 2 degrees Fahrenheit. This, again, I emphasize, should be our goal. Now, our country, this glorious America, emits some 25% of the world's greenhouse gases, despite the fact we're but 4% of the world's population. This makes us the largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world. Yet today, the federal government is doing nothing to stop global warming. We should be leading the charge. Here in the United States, the two most significant pieces of the puzzle are, number one, transportation, cars, trucks, planes, cargo ships, which account for approximately 33% of carbon dioxide emissions, and electric generation, largely from coal-fired power plants, which account for 38% of carbon dioxide emissions. If we were to clean up these two areas, we would go a long way toward our goal of containing temperature increases to 1 to 2 degrees. So let's begin with transportation. Fundamentally, there are two ways to reduce transportation emissions. First, improve the fuel efficiency of vehicles. And secondly, move away from oil and gasoline-based fuels and toward alternatives. Cars and trucks in the United States produce nearly 1.2 billion tons of carbon dioxide a year. That's 20% of U.S. emissions and 50% of all passenger vehicle emissions all over the world. The reason it's disproportionate is because we use our cars more and we drive longer than most other countries. The good news is that technology exists today to significantly improve fuel economy of vehicles. The bad news is that Detroit and many foreign auto manufacturers refuse to use the available technologies to produce increased mileage and better fuel economy. Senator Olympia Snowe of Maine and I have introduced legislation which would require the mileage of all cars, pickup trucks, and SUVs be increased from 25 to 35 miles per gallon over the next 10 years. And it's doable with existing technology. Now, what would be the result? 420 million metric tons of CO2 would be prevented from entering the atmosphere by 2025. That's the equivalent of taking 90 million cars off the road in 1 year. 2.5 million barrels of oil a day would be saved by 2025. Now, by coincidence, this is the amount of oil imported daily from the Persian Gulf today. So the savings are consequential. The other side of the coin
is the oil money that you received in this election.
I'll be happy to talk about that later. The other side of the coin is alternative fuels.
Will you sign the pledge?
As long as our nation continues its addiction to oil, we cannot sufficiently slow the warming trend.
Please end your own addiction, Senator.
Thank you. Rather,
we need action. You are right about global warming.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We need to quickly get up and running the development of clean new technologies and alternative fuels. This includes the electric plug-in hybrid, biodiesel fuels, hydrogen power, and ethanol 85 made from cellulosic ethanol. 37 million gallons of biodiesel were produced in 2004 in the United States, and that number more than doubled to 75 million in 2005. But additional incentives are needed in both public and private sector to move more aggressively toward producing and using alternative fuels. The second major piece of the puzzle is the generation and consumption of electricity. And the biggest culprit here is pulverized coal. Today, coal-fired plants in 38 states are the largest source of carbon dioxide in America. Coal alone produces 30% of annual carbon dioxide emissions, or 2.1 billion tons each year. Globally, coal produces 9.3 billion tons of carbon dioxide every year, or one-third of all global greenhouse gas emissions. It's absolutely critical that we find ways to clean up coal or find alternatives. Earlier this year, the Senate Energy Committee held a conference on the way forward on global warming. The clear consensus was that a mandatory cap and trade system was the most effective way to prompt changes in energy production, especially with regard to pulverized coal plants. Now, there have been cap and trade bills introduced in the Senate, and we are working to draft one that would create a national framework within which greenhouse gas emissions from coal plants, utilities, the transportation sector, and other major carbon dioxide producers can be reduced. Here's how it would work. A cap on the amount of critical global warming gases, including carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide, would be established on all major emitters. In all likelihood, the cap would remain at present levels for a period of time to allow companies to change their operations. Gradually, these caps would be tightened until the desired level is reached. Coal plants would have two ways to meet the cap: either implement new technologies or purchase credits from other companies that have reduced their emissions below the target cap. So the cap would be met, and national levels of carbon dioxide would be reduced. Peter Darby, who is in the front row, the CEO of Pacific Gas and Electric, agrees that we need to act now, and PG&E is helping us with the necessary modeling and new analysis of a practical and doable program. And I want to say thank you, Peter, very much. One of the key elements of our program is that it would allow farmers and foresters to participate. Agriculture would participate and earn credits for emission reduction through green practices. These include tilling land less frequently, which is happening now in California too, planting trees on vacant land, and converting crops to those that can be used for biofuels, switchgrass, growing those things which can be used. Farmers and growers would then be able to earn dollars for acres converted to carbon sequestration and reduction. Details are still being worked out, but a properly implemented cap and trade program can work. And let me give you an example. Remember acid rain? Well, under the Clean Air Act, Cap and trade was implemented in the 1980s to target sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide emissions from electric utility plants in the Northeast. They were the primary culprits of acid rain. In the 16 years that cap and trade system has been in place, sulfur dioxide emissions have been reduced by about 34%, and nitrogen oxide emissions reduced by 43%. So cap and trade has been used in this country, and it is effective. And the governors of the seven northeastern states have now come together to institute a regional cap and trade system. Now, residential and commercial buildings account for 40% of United States energy use. And an aggressive energy program nationally could prevent a substantial amount of carbon dioxide from going into the air. For example, if all new construction and major retrofits were required to incorporate energy-efficient building materials, such as insulation, more efficient windows, renewable technologies like solar and wind, a significant reduction of carbon dioxide would result. Green construction is cost-effective. An initial $100,000 investment can result in a savings of $1 million or more over the life of the building. Another example would be to incentivize the purchase for all of us of energy-efficient appliances. Energy Star home products, such as air conditioners, furnaces, refrigerators, dishwashers, phones, even DVD players and televisions, must become a standard buying practice for all Americans. In 2005 alone, these products saved consumers $12 billion, and they reduced emissions by nearly 5%. That's an amount equal to taking 23 million automobiles off the road. In our state, energy use per person has not gone up in the last 20 years, while national energy use has skyrocketed by 50%. To be specific, Californians use 6,000 kilowatt hours per person, while the national average is 12,000 kilowatt hours per person. And last September, the state announced a $2 billion energy efficiency and conservation program to decrease carbon dioxide by approximately 3.8 million tons by 2008. That's good news. This is the equivalent of reducing California's energy emissions by 3.5%, or taking 650,000 automobiles off California roads. It all counts. California's program, I believe, can and should be replicated in a national program, and we will seek to do that. Now, you and I and others can also make a difference. Here are just a few suggestions which save energy and reduce carbon dioxide emissions. The purchase of energy-efficient light bulbs, which we just did for our home today. A 30-watt compact fluorescent bulb is equivalent to a 100-watt light bulb and will reduce more than 1,300 pounds of carbon dioxide over the life of the bulb. One bulb. Turn down your hot water heater by 10 degrees. That saves 660 pounds of carbon dioxide per household. If every household were to do it, California alone would save 3.8 million tons of carbon dioxide. Wash 4 out of 5 loads of laundry in cold water. That avoids 460 pounds of carbon dioxide from being emitted, or 2.7 million for all of California. It adds up. Run your dishwasher only with a full load. That avoids 200 pounds of carbon dioxide from being emitted per household per year, or 1.2 million tons for all of our state. Turn your air conditioner thermostat up a single degree. That has major savings. Carpool 2 days a week. That avoids 1,500 pounds of carbon dioxide. Keep your tires inflated. That avoids, believe it or not, 250 pounds of carbon dioxide. Now, all of these are easy to do, and they make a difference, and people are doing them in this state. We really need to be a model and encourage everyone to do it. Now, it's doubtful in the short time remaining in the legislative session that we're going to see action on global warming. So in January, which will be the first day of the 110th Congress, it's my intention to introduce three bills. The first is the mandatory cap and trade program I told you about. The second is to reintroduce the 10 for 10 bill, which would increase mileage by 10 miles, 25 to 35, over the next 10 years. And the third would be a national energy efficiency program modeled after what California has achieved, including strict appliance and building standards and requiring utilities to use energy efficiency measures to meet a portion of their demand. Finally, we as a country have to lead. We should make global warming a top priority. We should join the European Union and other nations in reducing emissions. The carbon dioxide in the atmosphere comes from all countries. It affects all countries. So the United States can and must lead, but it can't solve the problem itself. All countries have to participate. China, India, Brazil, and other developing economies must be weaned away from fossil fuels. The Kyoto Protocol is certainly not perfect, and it will expire in 2012. But the United States needs to be a leader and ensure that there is in place a framework after 2012 to prevent catastrophic climate change. We should also initiate an effort to lead with China to raise a public-private partnership fund to prioritize bilateral global warming projects. Today, the United States and China are the world's largest emitters of greenhouse gases. For China, reliance on coal remains chiefly responsible for its carbon dioxide output. China's coal use outpaces that of the United States, the EU, and Japan combined. That's the size of this problem. Coal accounts for 70% of China's needs, and consumption is increasing 14% annually. So on its current trajectory, China is going to pass the United States soon as the largest emitter of carbon dioxide. So a private-public partnership that funds key carbon dioxide reduction projects on a bilateral basis would be an effective way for our countries to work together. This proposal was made about 3 weeks ago at an Aspen strategy group in which I participated. It was made by Sandy Berger, who was President Clinton's national security advisor. It had a very positive response. And that evening, two major American companies came over and said to me, "We would like to participate." Now, taken together, the policies I've outlined tonight really can make a significant difference. You have to look no further than across the Atlantic to see what can be accomplished. Already, Great Britain has brought its emissions to 14% below 1990 levels. They've done this through a comprehensive program requiring commercial electricity suppliers to generate 10% of their electricity from renewables by 2010, making grants available for the installation of renewable sources and providing incentives for the use of more fuel-efficient vehicles and alternative fuels. Now, interestingly enough, the Senate passed a bill last year, but unfortunately, it was dropped in conference by the Republican majority. I intend to work with Senator Bingaman, who is the author of that bill, on moving this bill again this next year. The very good news is that California has entered into a groundbreaking partnership with Great Britain to address climate change by sharing best practices on how to reduce CO2 emissions. And this is just one of the state's efforts. The state has also enacted a law requiring a 30% reduction in greenhouse gases from tailpipes of passenger automobiles by 2016. This is going to help the state reduce emissions by 80% below 1990 levels. 10 other states have now followed California's lead, and Canada has adopted similar regulations. Now, it's very controversial, and the state is being sued, but the point is we're doing it, and it's important, and the results can be significant. California is also considering legislation right now. Negotiations are going on between the legislature and the governor that would reduce greenhouse gas emissions further to 2000 levels by 2010 and to 1990 levels by 2020. Problem is, they don't have, I believe, a specific methodology to do it. And like all things, the devil's in the details. Earlier this month, Los Angeles joined the Clinton Climate Initiative, along with 21 of the world's largest cities, to create an international consortium to reduce costs on energy-efficient products and share ideas on cutting greenhouse gas emissions. The state has already begun to reap economic benefits of cleaner, greener, and more efficient technologies and standards. For example, substantial venture capital funding is available today for clean energy products. And these new startups are expected to generate between 48,000 and 75,000 new jobs over the next 5 years. Here are just a few of the most promising. A Silicon Valley startup, Ion America, has raised $165 million to develop clean fuels that will produce both electricity and hydrogen to fuel our vehicles. Bill Gates has joined with venture capitalist Vinod Khosla, who is here somewhere tonight, right in the front row, to spearhead investment efforts in ethanol plants, which when completed will produce 220 million gallons by 2009, just a couple of years off. And others are investing in new ideas, inexpensive solar panels, windmills that you can build in your backyard for $10,000, and geothermal energy that harnesses the heat of the earth. So our state is leading the way, and we can be proud of that. But we're not alone. I mentioned the governors of the 7 eastern states, and they're working to achieve a 10% reduction by 2019 in their cap and trade program. So working together, I believe we can reduce our emissions sufficiently to stabilize the Earth's climate, to minimize warming, and to slow global temperature increases to the 1 to 2 degrees. So here's what I ask of you. Be energy conscious. Bring pressure on your utility. Right, Peter? On your utility. Your government. Right, Diane? And commit yourself and your family to reduce energy consumption wherever possible. Don't shift the burden to the next generation, because the choice is clear, and the time is now to stop talking and start acting. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Senator Dianne Feinstein for her comments today. My name is Bob Saldick. I am the chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors. I will be conducting today's question and answer portion of our program. And Senator Feinstein, we have a lot of questions here. So let's plunge right in.
Wow,
a few of them deal with the science here, so let's examine this question. Some critics claim that some of the changes you mentioned, glacial melting, hurricanes, et cetera, are just part of a natural cycle. How strong is the science against this criticism?
I think it's emerging to be very strong. A while back, I think there was real controversy. I think that's disappearing. And I think increasingly people are seeing what's happening and seeing the speed with which it's happening on Greenland, Antarctica, the Arctic, Alaska, the Portage Glacier, and on and on and on. And I've become convinced, as a matter of fact, I have never had anyone, and I would challenge anyone, to give me one new paper that eschews global warming and says it's a false concept.
Thank you. A lot of the questions are political questions, and so let me kind of summarize them a little bit. What is the chance of Congress passing legislation to slow global warming? How does the president feel about this, and would he sign such a bill? And further, just today, Senator McCain said he would lead a Republican delegation overseas to examine global warming. Please comment.
Yes. Well, Senator McCain has actually been a leader, and Senator Lieberman. They had the first cap-and-trade bill, which went down. I can tell you this. If Democrats take control of one house, either the Senate or the House, you're going to see some global warming legislation emerge.
What are the chances? What are the chances of that?
Well, I can pull out my divining rod and say they're actually pretty good, don't you think?
A lot of frustrated questions about government action. Why don't we really recommend a substantial increase in the gas tax? We have a couple of Europeans here saying, do you realize that you pay at $3 a gallon, you're paying less than half of what we pay for gasoline and have for years?
Yes. I know very well Europeans feel that way. But Americans don't. And it's a difficult problem. People in California have to drive long distances to get to and from work. The budget cuts affect transportation because of a lot of policies that I can explain, but I won't go into now. Therefore, there isn't the transportation infrastructure that there should be in a country of our size. It is a significant lacking. We should have a rail spine down the center of California. We should have fast trains. We should have more buses. And we need that very much. We need really to concentrate on moving away, though, I think, from fossil fuel consumption and developing alternative fuels. The E85 prospect is the best. And you can use your present car if there were E85. Just with a few changes to the automobile, it can accept E85, which produces virtually no carbon dioxide. You can't get it yet because there isn't enough of it. Brazil has really been the first, I think, working on it. But now, and Vinod can tell you, there are more efforts to produce the capital to really invest in the plants and to see that the kind of biofuels are grown that can be used. Sugar. At Lawrence Livermore, I was told that even termites that produce an enzyme that can be used, the sugar of which can be used for biofuels. So the world is very big in terms of the substitutes that are available. It's the innovation, it's the R&D, it's the investment in capital that's really needed.
I think we have a few termites we could contribute. A lot of people are saying, isn't this a massive government issue, and shouldn't we have a Manhattan Project to address it? Governor Schwarzenegger, speaking at this club a couple of weeks ago, said that he loved Al Gore's movie and said that he was totally supportive. So the question is, have you had any discussions with Governor Schwarzenegger and the other leaders in the state of California to synchronize proposed state and federal climate change legislation?
Well, my staff has been working very closely with his staff. As a matter of fact, my chief of staff talked with his chief of staff today and on what's happening in the California legislature. And the answer is yes. And what we intend to do is try to move the California program on energy efficiency into a national program. And so we will be working with the governor.
You've mentioned the cap and trade program. Could you elaborate a little bit on what that is?
Well, okay, I tried to do it as much as I can. Cap and trade is where you control the emissions by putting a cap on the amount of the chemicals emitted from the facility that you want to prevent the emission of. And most likely, you would keep it at present levels for a few years to give companies the opportunity to make the investments and the changes that they would need to. And then they would have to reach the cap. Now, there are different ways they can reach the cap. One is new technology. The other would be to trade credits with those who produce clean energy and are below their cap. And that eases the transition for some, like coal. It makes it more workable for coal plants. And then you would include agriculture, and you would give credits for the growing of energy crops that could be used in cellulosic ethanol and for other forms of biofuels. And they do this in Europe. It works. They're just reevaluating the European system now. And I think we should take a page from that book. And this is what we are trying to do. Now, it's very difficult. Coal dominates in 38 states. Multiply 38 times 2 and recognize there are 100 United States senators. And where are you going to get the votes to pass something? So it has to be a plan that is doable and that has some industry support. This is why we are trying to work with the clean energy group of the utilities industry to try to see if we can't develop a cap and trade plan, which is doable and practical and will have some industry support, because without it, it'll just go down like every other bill has gone down. This is the challenge, and this is the hard part of legislating. It's not hard to put forward the best thing you know and pound your chest and say, you know, this is the best thing since sliced bread. It's another thing to get it passed and signed into law. And I'm interested in getting something passed, getting us on the track, the right track, and getting it signed into law as soon as possible.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is United States Senator from California, Dianne Feinstein. Let's turn to nuclear. This is a completely pollution-free, except for some waste materials, pollution-free electrical generating system. France has 80% of their power coming from nuclear power plants. We're far from that. Where do you stand on nuclear power, and do you think there is a chance to dramatically increase nuclear power building in this country?
I have never been a fan of nuclear power for two reasons. The first is the waste problem. And the waste has a half-life of forever. So when you embed it in the earth, it's there for all time. Now, that's changing because they're finding new ways to handle and recycle the waste. So that's the good news. The second thing was the safety factor. And that, too, is changing as new nuclear facilities become safer or engineered somewhat differently. So we are watching and looking. I'm keeping an open mind. The questioner is correct. It's clean power. That's the advantage of it.
The California legislature is putting the finishing touches on AB 32, a bill to require greenhouse gas emission limits in California. What is your position on this bill, if you have one?
Yes. Well, this is the bill that I just mentioned that my chief of staff talked with the governor's chief of staff on this morning, and the negotiations are going on between the speaker and the author, Senator Pavley, to be able to produce a bill. I am very supportive. I think the legislature has done a very good job in this. I would urge that they reach an accommodation with the governor. I do believe the governor wants to have a solid bill and a workable bill, and I believe that they can make that accommodation, and hopefully it'll be in the next day or so.
The other solution that many people ask about are electric cars, and with some of the new electric cars that are being designed today, they're talking about getting hundreds of miles to a gallon of gas because of a vastly increased battery capacity. Should the government be doing something to spur the investment in electric cars rather than grinding them up and putting them into waste dumps?
Absolutely. I think that was ridiculous. There's no question about it. We should be spurring every alternative means we can. And, you know, making purchases of the federal fleet of automobiles from energy cost-effective vehicles, whether it's electric plug-in or hybrid or whatever. I think it's really important that the government sets the tone. It's just so hard to convince people. There's a period of denial. I can only speak for the Senate because that's where I work. But it's amazing. The dicta was said, there will be no energy bill this year. Now we'll try. That's why we're going to try for next year. But I think if people are enlightened with CEOs like Peter Darby who care, who want to do it, who are prepared to move their industries, with venture capitalists like Vinod Khosla who are prepared to invest the money into the alternatives, we can move ahead. And if all of you can become involved and pressure your government, write to the chairman of the Environment Committee. He's the Senator James Inhofe from Oklahoma. Write to him. Tell him how strongly you feel about it. I'm used to a lot of people protesting. I've been at this a long time. And what's interesting to me is they always sort of go for the thing that doesn't do it. This is monumental. This is a huge, growing issue. We're at a point where if we don't move in a major way, the earth is going to tip. The climate is going to tip. And so this means there's no one silver bullet that's going to do it. The key is the combination of a number of things that get you to that 70%. This is 70% below 1990 levels. That's a big change. And that gets us to 450 parts per million of carbon dioxide. And that gets us to controlling warming to 1 to 2 degrees. So the things we have to do are big things. And that's why no one anywhere in the United States should approve a new pulverized coal plant that either can't show that they can sequester carbon dioxide. No one. And states right now are moving to permit. Texas is one of them, to permit the development of 11 new pulverized coal plants. That's shocking to me. The pollution is enormous in carbon dioxide.
Along that line, what is your stance on the proposal to allow oil platforms to be placed along the continental shelf around the United States?
I'm 100% opposed to offshore oil drilling. I've been there from the very beginning. I remember the early 70s when I was a supervisor. I remember the oil spills. The California coast is not a place for drilling. And my colleague and I, we will do everything we possibly can, including filibustering anything that comes to the floor that would allow it. Now, what we have to do, the moratorium expires, and we have to be in a few years. And so we have to get that federal moratorium and state moratorium reimposed.
Let's stay with the oil companies. Is their revenue and profit at all justifiable?
In my opinion, it is not. And I know a little bit about it because I'm on the Energy Committee, and we have had all the five CEOs from Big Oil before us. I think the profits are unconscionable at a time of $3 a gallon gasoline. The Senate Committee on Investigations in August this month has put out a report which shows that in this report, and I can make it available to anyone who wants to look at it, that the price of oil is not related to supply and demand. It's related to futures speculation that there is more oil available than there has been in a long time right now. So this brings up a whole other thing that we call the Enron loophole that I have been trying to plug, because one of the problems is futures trading in energy on electronic trading platforms is without a record, and there is no transparency, which means it is in secret. And so there's no way for the commission that's in charge, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, to really know what is traded on the futures market when it is done off of an electronic platform. And what we have been trying to do, and will do when a certain bill comes to the floor, is move an amendment which says that a record must be kept of all of these trades. They must be transparent so that the Commodities Futures Trading Commission can look at the trade and make a judgment as to whether that trade is manipulative. In other words, whether it's a wash trade, whether it's get shorty or get Harry or get anybody else, the schemes that Enron used, which bilked Californians to the tune of $28 billion. Not only Enron, but other companies as well.
As a follow-up, does your campaign accept contributions from oil and gas companies?
We may have some. I don't think we have much. It would be very de minimis. I can't really answer that question right now.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is United States Senator from California, Dianne Feinstein. Let's tack a little bit of politics into the meeting. What prevents the current administration from taking serious action regarding global warming?
The energy policy of this administration has basically been on behalf of big oil. And it's what I deeply believe. It's what I've seen. It's not been to move toward alternative fuels, to see that the incentives are there. It's not been to recognize that global warming is real and it's happening. And it's been a very complacent business as usual administration. That's all I can say.
The Democratic Party still has lots of trouble clarifying its messages to the voter. What can be done to change this?
Well, I think the Democratic Party's message is very clear in this election. Do you want to know what it is? Democrats took the nation out of a period of deficit during the administration of Bill Clinton. And in the last 4 years of Clinton's term, with the Democratic Congress, the budget was balanced. And a surplus was developed. It was projected over 10 years at $5.6 trillion when President Clinton left office. Since then, with exception of the first year of President Bush, there has been a deficit each year. And the debt is now predicted to be $11 trillion over 10 years. That's an unsustainable level of debt. And what has happened is that the Democrats have become the deficit hawks, and the Republicans have become the big spenders. They would spend it on different things, on tax cuts for the very wealthy, on which are about $3 trillion over 10 years in amount, fighting to eliminate the estate tax, which is another the proposal before us is $750 billion in cost, and in cutting domestic programs. We would not do that. We would protect Social Security. Today, one half of the American workforce across the board has no pension or retirement benefit from their employers. One half. Therefore, the only thing they have on retirement is Social Security. And it's extraordinarily important that it be kept intact. And we know there are ways to do that. There would be stem cell research if Democrats were in power. And those are just three things that would happen for sure, and a bill on global warming.
Let me go back to some of the technology here. Several people have challenged the idea that corn products are useful here because it takes more energy to process this fuel than the savings. If that's true, why is our government subsidizing this energy source as a green source?
I agree. Corn ethanol has an adverse energy ratio, meaning it takes more energy to produce it than it saves. And it is a product of, I'm sorry to say this, Midwestern politics. It has a mandate. It has a subsidy. And there is a tariff on the importation of ethanol that might be cheaper. It is bad public policy. I voted against it, and I continue to vote against it. Now, so some corn ethanol is going to be produced. But what's changed is increasingly people now understand that there is better sources for ethanol than corn. And that's where we need to go as a nation. That's where the incentives and the subsidies have to be for a period of time. So I'm from removing the subsidy from corn ethanol and putting it on cellulosic ethanol, which has a very strong energy coefficient.
Will you author or at least support an amendment to the Clean Air Act directing the EPA to regulate greenhouse gas emissions? Apparently an issue today before the Supreme Court of Massachusetts versus the EPA. And they said thank you.
Well, the answer is of course. And that is a case that is before the court, if I recall correctly, as to whether the EPA can, in effect, regulate global warming gases under the Clean Air Act. And if there is any problem, the answer is absolutely yes, there will be legislation to create that mandate. We believe that the Clean Air Act already provides that mandate. So that's for the court to decide.
Unfortunately, we're coming to the point in our program where there's only one last question, and I have to ask, do you think Hillary Clinton could realistically be the next Democratic presidential nominee? Any interest on your part?
Oh. I think Hillary Clinton will be, if she runs, a very strong candidate. I mean, who knows what will happen? This is a very imprecise, unstable, volatile world right now, internationally, even domestically, with a lot of very serious problems. And the campaign has not begun. There are going to be many different candidates. And the American people, I think, are going to have to make some very tough choices in this election. So, I mean, I can't say who is going to win or who is going to lead, nor can anyone else, candidly. But I can say the Democratic Party will field a number of very strong candidates.
And your own position?
My own position is I'm running for the United States Senate for re-election, and I would anticipate that I'd spend the next 6 years in the Senate. Thank you very, very much. Thank you, everybody. Thank you very much. Am I finished?
Our thanks to Senator Dianne Feinstein for her comments today. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Bounce around a little bit.